Hey everybody, welcome back to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State, which is Wisconsin and beyond. Today we're with our friend Justin LeClaire, who lives in South Texas, which is one of the world's best known birding hotspots. So Justin, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Doing great. How are you guys?
Doing well.
I'm tired from yesterday. We did our first of the day birding challenge.
First of the year.
First of the year.
So
Yeah,
tired he doesn't even know if
the
it's a
first
day
of
or
the
a year.
day birding challenge.
Got to recover for a full day, maybe tomorrow.
Absolutely, yeah. But anybody listening right now or watching might recognize Justin because he's been in some of our videos from South Texas because he showed us around. Is that Stormy in the background? I see actually.
There's just a little
I
tail.
see a tail just coming up.
Stormy is Justin's dog, for those of you who are listening.
There she
Aw,
is.
Stormy.
There she is. Yeah.
Stormy is probably going to be in a video. I don't remember if Stormy was in the one where we went to Boca
A
Chica
little
Beach,
bit, I
but
think.
Stormy is going to make another appearance in some other videos as well.
She's a cutie.
Yeah, and she's a rescue, correct?
Yeah. Found her at Benson, Rio Grande State Park. Yeah, some folks will know where that is. She's wandering around the parking lot. So there's plenty of stray dogs down here if anybody needs a forever best friend to take back with them as well.
Yeah, South Texas, good birding, free dogs.
Yeah, pretty much.
I really
Yeah.
think about taking a dog on the podcast. Like last week too, we were talking about how Derek tried to steal someone's dog.
There was no dog stealing. A lady accused us of trying to steal her dog once when we were birding.
Oh my God.
It just came out. They had like a fenced in yard. They're like, why are you trying to steal my dog? It was weird.
He might have been. I wasn't there. He could have been trying to steal a dog.
So
Could
anyway,
have.
being in the Rio Grande Valley, South Texas, I feel like people don't necessarily have a good idea of what the area is like. Like they think it's kind of like this lawless just area where there's just anarchy. So
Which, of course, it is.
what's it like being in the valley and birding there?
It's definitely very interesting. It can be a little bit of a culture shock if you haven't traveled much, especially as northern folks. I'm from Vermont, so I had been in Southern California and kind of experienced the, the Hispanic culture mixing in with American culture. It's very much like normal down here, it feels like. It's there's this is this area has a really cool mix of like four different real big ecoregions. So you've got the subtropics from the south, the deserts from the west, the Great Plains from the north, and then you've got the coastal influence as well, from the Gulf Coast here. So it's a really cool mix of species. We've got two flyways that go right through here. The Mississippi and Central Flyways kind of converge as they go down the Gulf Coast right here. So there are just, hundreds of millions of birds that pass through here every year, and that makes for some awesome migratory birding. In addition to, the things that people come here to see: green jays and great kiskadees and plain chachalacas and Altamira orioles, and lately, of course, some really crazy rarities that pop up, every winter or otherwise throughout the year. But it's really like I've never felt more worried here than anywhere else that I've birded at any point in my 8 years here. A lot of people will post on Facebook, like, oh, is it safe to like go down there right now? The US side it's perfectly safe. There are certainly some cartel issues on the Mexican side. But on this side of the border, like there's no problem at all. Like even in this rural Santa Margarita Ranch, where these crazy things are popping up recently and it's gotten to be a really hot spot. It's in the middle of nowhere in Starr County. 2 hours away, upriver, and there's no issues with safety really in that
We were
regard.
actually chatting about that last week too, because we touched on South Texas a little bit because Eric, our friend who we were talking to, had just went down there, and we were reminiscing about when we were looking across from Boca Chica Beach across the river and just seeing Mexico there, and we were just like, yeah, it's kind of just a thing. Like you don't really think about it that much that you're looking at Mexico, and we didn't run into any problems when we were down there whatsoever. But it is funny because I feel like whenever we post a video from there, some of our subscribers are like, best be safe over there, like watch out, like watch your back down there near Mexico.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember, the first few times that I was down here and seeing the Rio, seeing the, especially from like the beach, and so you get to see that aspect of it, or you go to Sable Palm Sanctuary or Santa Ana and you can see Mexico. And it's like, oh my God, Mexico's like right there. But it's just like, fact of life now. I lived 10 miles from the border of Canada in Vermont, and it feels as normal as that was, now living this close to Mexico.
So I guess you're just a border guy then.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. A border birder.
He's always on the periphery of the country, essentially. But you mentioned some of the rare stuff that's seen down there. And before we were actually recording, we were talking to you about how wild some of your days have been in terms of the hours that you're putting into guiding right now. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the crazy things that have been seen in the last couple of months there that are really drawing birders down to the region?
Yeah, there's been some really spectacular rarities this fall, this winter. Lately, the last couple that we've had have both been out on Santa Margarita Ranch in Starr County. That's what I'm mentioning, is a couple hours upriver west of here in Harlingen. That's the upper lower valley, I guess. But most recently, a mottled owl is a third U.S. record. And the only one that's been chaseable. There was a roadkill record from out near Benson, and then another bird from Weslaco. That was, I think, seen only. There was no proper documentation other than notes from memory. So this is the first bird that people could chase and see, and it's perfectly fine habitat. And you know, you never know if there happens to be a second bird there, or a second bird that shows up, if they're going to try to, you know, stay there longer or whatnot. It's owl mating season now, so. But just before that as well, during the Rio Grande Valley Birding Festival, there was a bare-throated tiger heron found there on a festival trip, which is awesome.
Derek's group found it, actually.
Our festival.
Yes, that's right. You were there. I forgot about that. That's right. Yeah. And so, I mean, you can explain how crazy that was to just have show up right in front of you.
Yeah. It was wild because, like, we were trying to find other rare stuff there at the ranch. There's like this lookout where you can look over the river and into Mexico. It's just like a really cool view. And so there you're kind of looking for like red-billed pigeon. We were looking for, the Morillette seed eater and kind of the grasses. And so we're kind of all preoccupied looking for these other things. And then, you know, someone mentioned like, oh, there's an American bittern. It's like, how cool to have an American bittern out in the open. Like, cause just a brief glance, that's kind of what the most logical thing would be. And then I mentioned last week, our friend Brian Koch, like, put his binoculars up and he's just like, that's a bare-throated tiger hare. And everyone's like, whoa. And somebody got pictures and we're all like huddled around, like being like, yeah, like you can.
Was it like the scene in the big year where Bostic and that guy crash and then they see the gray spotted woodpecker and he's like, that's the rarest bird I've ever seen.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
It was, our group was like separated from the other group who was like on top. So then we like sent someone over to make sure everybody like had seen it. I think everybody did get eyes on it. Maybe one person didn't. Ooh. But then later they found out that that person didn't care at all if they saw it or not. So everyone who wanted to see it got to see it. But then since then, it seems like other people have gotten really good views. I saw Ryan Rodriguez had like a cover photo, you know, quality image of it.
He probably like crawled through the muck and the grass to get that, I would imagine.
Well, that's kind of how it's been. So it disappeared for a couple weeks. We didn't know how to find it, and then we started getting kind of in the actual riverside habitat of the ranch. There's a fence line, and so we had to work out access, and you have to kind of cross over a barbed wire fence, and now we have a staircase actually. Ooh. That the ranch owner put
moving up in the world there.
Because that's what everybody wants to go see, is the tiger heron, of course, one of the things. And so it's been hanging out in this like little back slough thing on the side of the Rio. And so you can't see it from the bluff. You can't see it from the trail. You have to like go down through this, like, you know, waist high guinea grass, fallen logs and all this stuff, and get in there and like sneak around and kind of hunt for this tiger heron in this little backwater area. And that's where it's been hanging out and where we've been getting photos occasionally. Like, it'll see us somehow before we see it. It's really sneaky. It might be roosting even 20 feet up in a tree during the daytime because they are nocturnal or crepuscular from what I understand. So it'll flush, may fly into Mexico, and we'll just walk out onto this island that's in the Rio and just get a look from like, you know, 50 feet away, 100 feet away, and just get fantastic looks at this bird just hanging out there. And this is a third U.S. record as well.
Yeah, when we were walking down to look for the brown jays, which we didn't actually see that day, but it made like, we saw it fly out again. And it made this like real weird grunting, kind of like, like it sounded like a wild boar almost.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. It's very similar to a great blue, but yeah, more like guttural. It's kind of scary.
It's interesting. But so Santa Margarita Ranch is private access, so you can't just go there. You need to go. You need to pay access and then have a guide as well.
Yeah, basically, you need to have a guy there that knows the ranch, that has been accepted by the ranch owner, basically, that, you know, he feels comfortable with you leading there. So there's, you know, a half dozen or so people at least that are doing that now. And there's a couple folks that are doing it more than others just because they're more available, or that they've been doing it since the Brown Jays showed up. So, you know, they know the ranch like the back of their hand, like literally, like, oh, that's where the, you know, Rosso de Picard is going to be. That's where the Dusky Cap is going to be. There's been a crazy list of rarities that have popped up there this year, with of course the mottled owl and tiger heron being the, you know, cherries on top.
Is that where you get seed eaters too there?
It's one of the places. Oh, yeah. Okay. So yeah. When I was there, some people from our group actually saw one. I didn't see it personally, but they'll pop out every once in a while. So it's like
they're kind of rough to get, like,
it's tricky. Yeah, it's a premier spot for like a lot of those you know, really South Texas birds. Like, you can only get certain ones at the ranch. So if people want to go do this, what's the best way to kind of reach out and see if you can do a tour there?
Right now, I guess generally, if you're trying to do a mottled owl tour, there's only a few of us that are really allowed to do that right now, because it is, you know, the ranch owner is letting people on after dark.
Yeah.
And so that's just a few of us, the best bet to do that. Most of January is booked up, but they'll start booking up, or they'll start opening trips up after that, especially for Wednesdays and Saturdays when we've been doing trips. It's the email address is mottledowlsmr, as in Santa Margarita Ranch, at gmail.com. So that one's really easy. The other one, you can use Santa Margarita txranch@gmail.com. That's kind of for general trips, and they'll kind of throw you wherever. But there are a handful of guides, like I guide there's a few other guys, Ryan Rodriguez, Jesse Huth, Cameron Cox, I think, has a couple trips coming up there. And so there are some other folks that can guide there as well. But those two email addresses will get you there.
Well, you know, it's a rare bird when it has its own email address that you can come to regarding it.
First chaseable, and it's been the owl has been somewhat cooperative. Some people get some really good looks. Almost every trip has heard it. I think we had one trip where we didn't hear it or see it, unfortunately.
Oh, that's tough.
It happens, you know, it's an owl. So
yeah. So what about some of the other rarities? I know the gray-collared Picard is pretty huge, and that's, like, you know, probably more easily accessible than, you know, Santa Margarita Ranch.
Yeah, Resaca de la Palma State Park in Cameron County has just been amazing. It's situated like right between Harlingen and Brownsville. And I don't even know what started there. Maybe a blue bunting to start. A male blue bunting had been seen there for a couple days during the festival. And then a roadside hawk was seen. A golden crown warbler was seen. A rose throated Picard was seen. A gray collared Picard was then found, which is also a third ABA area record. So we've had three ABA area third records this fall/winters in the gray-collared Picard, mottled owl, and tiger heron, bare-throated tiger heron. So those, in addition to, you know, all these like really good Mexican rarities that we regularly get, those guys, you know, the roadside hawk is a really good one as well. There's been at least three in the valley too. There was one at Benson State Park, and there was another one in Cameron County at a off-limits refuge. So at least three this year. And then, you know, crimson-collared grosbeak, there's been three or four other golden crown warblers, one or two other blue buntings. There was one at Estero this year. So as far as Mexican vagrants goes, it's just been like fantastic. But we've also had northern birds that have been really good, and western U.S. birds. Like desert species, you know, we've had really good numbers of things like brewer sparrows and green-tailed towhees, and just these things we don't normally get, you know, every winter. Just kind of like everything's coming at us from all directions, it seems like. So this is like one of the best winters in memory in South Texas.
I'm starting to feel like we did not have as good of a time when we went down there as we could have. Because when we went down there, it was like the hook-billed kites were a thing, and the rose-throated Picard was a thing, and then there were some the tropical perulas, which I don't like to talk about because we didn't ever get to see one. But that was pretty much all that was down there at that point in time.
So then when I was down there for the festival, I'm like, oh man, there's so much cool stuff. Cause, like, you know, roadside hawk, you know, all the stuff at Santa Margarita. And then when I left, I'm like, man, there's even more cool stuff now than when I was just there. Just like, it just keeps increasing on unique species that show up.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed too about South Texas that was really different than any other place that I'd birded ever was how ecos or how centered on the ecotourism, I guess it is what I'm trying to say, is that like every place you go, it's structured so that you can bird there and so that you can have access to the birds. Like up here, if there's something rare at a nature center, the people that work in the nature center most likely won't know where it is or that it's there. Down in Texas, it's like you can go to almost anybody, it feels like, that's an employee of those centers, and be like, where has this been? What time is it usually seen? And they know. You know, it's just like laid out very well for birding and for ecotourism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have 20 or 30 staffed nature parks in general here in the valley. And you know, that includes like four state parks and several refuges, but then a bunch of private places as well. Like Sable Palm Sanctuary and Edinburgh Scenic Wetlands and Frontera Audubon and all these really cool places that have, you know, staff that are knowledgeable about birds, but also of course they want to know where these rarities are. And I think, like, you know, Resaca de la Palma is a great example of that. You know, it's a state park, but it was really underbirded for a long time, and that will never be the case now, because there's, you know, a dozen rarities that have been found there this fall and winter. And so people are, you know, starting to understand that, you know, any of these parks can be really fantastic for birds. And I think the people staffing those parks really appreciate, you know, everybody coming as well.
Yeah, one other thing is like most of them do have some kind of entry fee, which I'm assuming goes mostly to, you know, help support those parks and kind of the industry. And I think most of the time birders are okay with paying a fee if they feel like it actually is serving a purpose. Especially like with, you know, Santa Margarita, obviously people are willing to chip in a little bit to see some of these cool things.
Yeah, that's a tricky one too. You know, the ranch owner is going to charge what they want. But then, you know, you do have to, you have to have a guide going with you. And so for that guide to go, you know, you can only take so many trips with friends basically, and, you know, let folks on for free before it's like, okay, you know, if you're doing this every week or whatever, it's just a lot of time that's required. And so, yeah, you do have to charge, you know, a guide fee in addition to what the ranch owner is charging basically. So it can make it definitely a little more costly.
Yeah, it does make me want to just buy a plot of land down there and just like get
That's
a bunch of
actually going to
people on it
suggest
and
that,
find
because
some
like,
rare birds. And
wouldn't you? I'm assuming land down there can't be that pricey, right? Like you could just buy a plot, like put a shed on it, put some fruit out, and just see what happens.
if you've got some nice riparian woods, sure. If you're on the Rio,
You go.
you never know. Sky's the limit.
So multiple people I know do take trips down into Mexico. And I've always like going to Mexico seems a little daunting to me. Like I'm just convinced if I went down there, I would get like
Abducted.
abducted or something, you know, would happen. But like the people are going are normally like older retired people or like younger homeschool kids, and they seem to do just fine. And they're like, it's great.
That's the crowd that runs the mean streets of Mexico, the homeschool kids and the retirees.
So have
Much.
you gone down into Mexico? And if you did you feel comfortable doing
Or
so?
did you get abducted slash are you calling from a cartel house?
Yeah, blink twice if yes. No, I haven't gone down. I know when I first moved down here, I think it had just started getting a little bit sketchy on that side of the border. So like people will still go if they're in a group, you know, especially on like a bus tour type of thing, with a company where they don't have to be the ones driving their vehicle, you know, a ways down the roads, because that's where things can get a little sketchy. You know, especially if you're on any type of back roads. But no, people still go across all the time just to like the markets just on the other side of the border. You know, I know that there was a lull in you know, what we call our winter Texans that would go over the border there for a while, but I think things are getting a little better over there in that regard. And folks will start going over again on, you know, weekends, or I have some friends that go over for like dental work because it's way cheaper or something like that.
That's what we heard too.
But I haven't personally done it now.
Here's a question for you. So since we're talking all about going down to South Texas, if you're just a random person that's never been there before, what are the, we'll say, five places that on any year you definitely have to hit? So like not, you know, this year, oh, the Tiger Heron's there, so go there. Just like anytime, what are your top five?
Man, that's hard. Okay.
I can give you some time to think if you want. I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that. We can.
It depends on the time of year too. You know, if you're coming in migration, you have to go to the coast. You have to go to South Padre Island. If you're going to be here in April or August through October, you know, because you never know what kind of migrants are going to be passing through and stopping by. There's it's almost all developed out there except for a couple little woodlots. Basically, you know, there's one woodlot and then there's two patches of wood side by side. One of them is the South Padre Island Birding and Nature Center, which is a great spot, great private park out there. But so other than that, so that's definitely one I would say is South Padre in general, the few places there are out there. Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge is probably my favorite down here. Really great spot. Ton of trails, got a great diversity. You can get 100 species easily on really any time of year. If you spend some time, you spend a good chunk of the day. Estero Llano Grande State Park is definitely another one that everybody talks about. It's been up and coming. You know, it's been around for a couple decades now. I think it was all agricultural fields previously, except for their what they call the tropical zone. There's a bunch of non-native plants in there in addition to native stuff. And it was a RV park, camper park. And that's kind of half of it now. So you've got the tropical zone and then you've got this old area that was all ag fields and now is, you know, mesquite woodlands and these really nice different ponds that can have great ducks and, you know, shorebirds. And there's even limpkins now. So, two others. I mean, now Santa Margarita, the sky is the limit with that place too. Like that place is just nuts. And so that's probably number four right now that we've, you know, realized how amazing it is. And so that kind of covers like the upriver stuff, the things like pigeons and seed eaters and Audubon's Oriole is out there. You know, I don't really know another one. One I like to recommend is Edinburgh Scenic Wetlands for kingfishers. That's a really great spot to get all three kingfishers because people struggle to get those in like maybe, you know, 1 week being down here or however long they're down here. You can walk away and never see a ring kingfisher and maybe only see one green. But at Edinburgh, you have a good chance at seeing all three in the winter here in one morning there.
You ready for a trivia question?
Oh, God. Yeah. My memory is the worst, but yeah.
You know who is responsible for finding me my lifer-ringed kingfisher?
Oh, easy, right?
Yeah, it was you.
I was like, I've taken a couple people up that stretch. Yeah, easy.
Didn't make the video about it yet, but to anybody listening and watching, we had just gone through like this entire area. What's the place called that we went to?
The Arroyo Colorado is where we were.
Yeah, we had just gotten the yellow warblers in there that I call the mangrove warblers. We had seen a bunch of cool stuff and we mentioned that I hadn't seen a ring kingfisher yet. And so Justin is just like, yeah, we'll try this one stretch. There could be one there. And then that was the most excited I saw you the whole time when one was just hanging out there. Like, there it is. Yeah, it was so funny. And that was the only one we saw too. So if not for that extra effort, we would not have seen it. Which also, to anybody listening, Justin was an awesome guide down there. He was really on the ball with everything. Just knows all the species, where to find them, all the best places. It was pretty epic.
Working outside will do that. You're kind of birding for work pretty often, so spend a lot of time out there.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about you know, your work. That's actually how we met, was some red knot banding stuff. So can you tell us a little bit more about like what you do and how you got involved with that?
Yeah, so my full-time job is with a nonprofit called Coastal Bend Bays and Estuaries Program. We are a conservation organization. I'm on the bird program aspect of it, and so I'm a conservation biologist basically. You may hear the parakeets over here, the budgies chirping in the background, trying to keep them quiet. The lights on.
I was wondering if those were parakeets because
they're from down here too. They're strays. You know, they were pets, and you know, they don't last long down here. The parrots or grackles or hawks pick them off. So I took a couple in. That one that I had found came down to my hand to some seed in my hand, and
oh man, you have to take it home at that point.
Yeah, exactly. It was at my house. It was literally at my house. And so, yeah, I just brought it in.
That's so bad. How many do you have? Is it two of them?
It's just two. Yeah, it's one pair. Yeah.
Can we get a glimpse real quick? Or
yeah,
I don't know how hard it is to move the laptop.
I don't know if you could really see. There's one trying to incubate eggs right now that are not in the cup, but
oh, I can see it.
There.
Yeah,
and there's one more back up in the corner. Yeah. So they've got a little
I thought you were gonna say they're trying to incubate eggs because you're starting a parakeet rearing business inside.
they get wound up late at night when the lights are on. So anyway, my main job is to monitor and manage habitat for water birds and shorebirds. So really anything that lives on the coast is things that we might work with. Wading birds, especially, the organization has always monitored things like great blue herons and black skimmers and, you know, everything in between as far as a water bird, wading bird, gull kind of thing goes. And we manage the islands that they breed on down here in the Laguna Madre and other bays, just to increase the breeding habitat, increase structure, space for them to nest on, protect them from predators or from people that are getting on the islands. We do a lot of research as well, which is where, of course, we met. We do focus a lot on red knots, being such a long distance migrant. And they've had one of the subspecies, at least here in the U.S., has really struggled. And we didn't know too much about them, especially away from the East Coast. There's been a lot of research on the East Coast with them, the Delaware Bay, and how they relate to horseshoe crab eggs, of course. But not so much about the birds that go through the Gulf Coast. Of course, the Rosalari subspecies goes up, maybe it's backwards for you guys, but up the Pacific Coast is Rosalari, and the East Coast, the Atlantic Coast, is Rufa red knot, which is a federally threatened subspecies. And so the birds in the Gulf Coast, right in the middle, it's like, what are these? And it turns out it is a mix. It is mostly Rufa, but it is definitely a mix. Going either direction, north or south, and we have some that winter here as well, several thousand. So it's been really interesting to learn more about those. And of course, when we were together, we were putting some transmitters on them, and we've continued doing that off and on as the funding, you know, works out for the different, depending on what projects we have. So, you know, we do a lot of research in addition to monitoring and management. For some of these really cool species that are struggling a little bit more than others. Black skimmers are another one that we've done a recent project on down here. They've had a pretty tough time in the Gulf Coast compared to other water birds here.
Yeah, definitely. And, big props to all the National Estuary Programs. Of course, CBEP also BITNEP, the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program. A lot of cool stuff and cool conservation-based work that those organizations are doing. One of the things that surprised me so much about doing the red knot stuff was just the different ways that researchers catch birds. Because with the red knots, you're using the cannon net that is literally just using explosives to fire a net at these birds. Yep. And so just being around that, and of course, all the different ways to do it safely was pretty crazy. And then I feel like holding, you know, you get to hold a red knot and see it in the hand, you have just such a more appreciation for that species.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a whole different world when you actually get to see one of those things up in your hand, close, especially for the first time. But any new species, I guess, in the hand is really an experience to remember.
Do you keep a hand list?
You know, I don't, but I have thought about it so many times. And I do have like an album in my phone of birds in the hand. But I'm really curious what my number would be. It's definitely multiple hundreds.
Wow. Yeah,
that seems like something that all the banders like joke about, like, oh, my list's higher than yours. So when we did go out that same time when we were looking for the yellow warblers, I do recall you trying to catch an American oyster catcher, which, may not have gone as we planned.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't quite work out. Yeah. That's one that we monitor down here as well. They're in pretty low numbers here as you get down into the Laguna Madre from Corpus Christi south to the border of Mexico, actually. You know, there's really not too many pairs in that area. And so kind of seeing where they move and who they're teaming up with each year, mating. Interesting. Yeah. So that pair we tried to get. One of them was already banded, and we tried to get that second bird, and no luck getting them in close. They knew what was up.
I really feel like it remembered you, and it had like a vendetta. I was like, no, don't get close.
They got like close enough to make us think they were going to do it too, and like spend more time trying to catch them. And then just at the end,
I also remember you getting pinched by a crab.
Dude, we got pinched so hard by that crab. Right. I thought that I was going to lose.
That really cool crab. Yeah. That was a cool crab.
No, it was for a while.
Yeah. One of your crabs have been pinched by lists that you can keep from now on.
That's the only one I don't want to add to that list. Okay. That thing was surprisingly dexterous. Like, it just reached up behind its entire, like, shell and grabbed me somehow.
So it's Texas crabs, man. You got to watch out.
And I was, like, in a serious pain, and you're like, oh, that's a cool one.
Well, I remember I was filming it. Now he was, like, seriously getting injured by it. And I'm like, at what point is this, like, serious enough that I put the camera down and help him get this crab off his finger? But he figured it out.
Well, somebody said just set it down, and that's what finally did.
I think it was Justin.
It was probably Justin.
Yeah.
So this year was also my first time getting to go down and help with the festival and do some filming, which will eventually, you know, get the videos done on kind of the festival experience. But it was a really cool atmosphere, and just like, I feel like it was, especially that Rio Grande Valley Birding Festival was very good for beginners, like for birders that, you know, maybe like looked out their window, but like, I want to see some cool Texas stuff. Like, I thought it was, you know, really accessible to like the everyday person, and you were super involved with that. What was that like, being more involved with the running of the festival?
Yeah, it was a lot. I definitely was skeptical of taking on the role at first, knowing or not knowing how much, you know, was really going to come with it. So I was the field trip and guide coordinator this year, which is, you know, kind of one of the biggest roles, I guess, that's at least as far as the actual draw, you know, to get people to the festival. We have a bunch of other staff that volunteers or, you know, stipend paid basically, that also help organize everything. It's in addition to like 80 volunteers or something crazy like that. And then of course, you know, we bring in 70 or 80 guides depending on the year. Our participant numbers are getting back up there since COVID. You know, we did take a year off, and then a couple of years after that, we're subpar for sure compared to what we were at in 2019. But so everything went pretty well despite the pretty wild weather we had.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, we had 3 days basically just straight rain. There were pockets where it stopped, and some folks were able to take trips different directions where, you know, it wasn't so nasty, but it was a very trying year for sure. But overall it went, you know, really smoothly. It was really interesting seeing the, you know, the background of how festivals run and how much work really goes on into it. You know, when you're there as a guide, I guided for 6 or 7 years for the festival beforehand, while living down here since I moved here basically. And you know, it's such a good time. You know, you hang out, you see your buddies from all over the country, you know, and the participants, some are come year after year and get to go to some cool spots like Santa Margarita that nobody used to go outside of these festivals really previously. And so to kind of have the stress of organizing all that is definitely a different experience. But it gives me a real appreciation for, you know, every single person that helps put that on, and even the guides. I mean, you know, to have them come down and give their expertise and stay positive in these such terrible conditions. And it's all worth it when you get a crazy bird like a bare-throated tiger heron.
Yeah, it was great. I think I would definitely recommend it to anyone who's like on the fence or has never been to a birding festival. Like, I think that's a great first one for them. Because it really was a wide range of people who were just beginners or more advanced or wanted to see one specific species. But it was cool to see them at the start of the week and then be like, oh, I want to see this, 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 this. And then maybe on your tour, you see one. And then by the end, they're like, yeah, I saw everything I wanted to see. Like, I'm just out here to have a good time.
That's kind of what it was like when I went there, because I was like, you know, green jays. I got to see green jays and Altamira Orioles. And then like everywhere there was green jays. So I'm going to put you on the spot again, since we're talking about birds like that. What do you think are the top five birds that you have to see if you come down to the Rio Grande?
Top five birds.
Top five birds.
That you have to see. So you got to see a green jay. I mean, there's some really easy ones. So you will land in Texas and you will be like, oh, there's a green jay.
Will it be like your parakeet? It'll just land in your hand outside your house?
Maybe. Yeah, yeah. Maybe not, you know, not wild budgies, but yeah. You never know. Green jay has got to be one of them. I would say one of the Kingfishers, for sure. The Kingfishers are just so cool, especially I think green is, they're both cool. Ringed is like an upgraded version of Belted, so it's cool because it's really big, but I think green is really cool because it's this little tiny thing. With the bill is like as long as the body. The bill is like literally my whole index finger, mm-hmm. and then the bird is like my hand. Like it's got a massive bill. And it's just this little tiny thing. It literally fits in your, it can fit in your hand. I've held one. So there's a one for the hand.
Less than that bird in the hand.
I've held several. Yeah. I've caught him in mist nets while we were not trying.
That's why he knows exactly how long the bill is better than index finger. He's like, I know for a fact it's about the size of my hand.
Yeah. So those two for sure. I think people really love playing chachalacas. They're so kooky. They're so loud too. If you get to hear them, that chachalaca kind of call they do, and they get like a cacophony going. That's really fun. And they'll just like walk around and kind of look at you, kind of like a little mini turkey. Mm-hmm. They look like little feathered velociraptors.
Yeah, they do. Definitely. They're one of the birds that looks most like a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. And they're if you come in the early to mid summer, their chicks are so dang cute.
Oh man.
Okay, so that's three. Aplomato falcon has to go on the list. That's a really special species that was extirpated from the States, brought back with breeding programs, now are breeding on in the wild on their own. There is some supplemental birds being brought into the population still, some young birds. But there are, if you see an unbanded bird, which is pretty common, that's a fully wild bird. It was born in the wild, raised in the wild. Okay, so that's four there.
Those are some good picks so far too.
There's two other ones. I'm excited to see which one you go with out of the two I'm thinking of, if you do at all.
I think my last one, which is also one of my favorite species, I would have to say, is Groovebilled Awny.
That was not a two. I was thinking you had to include Great Kiskadee or Altamira Oriole.
I almost did, but we covered like the common, really cool stuff with Green Jay. So I'm trying to get like kind of a diversity of cool things.
Interesting.
I thought you were going to go with the super then go with the olive sparrow.
I thought about it because that's another one on festival trips. Everybody's like, I need to see an olive sparrow. And you're like, we'll hear them everywhere, but you probably won't see them because they just skulk around everywhere. They make this loud squeal sound and they're right in the shrubbery right in front of you. And they're there.
No, I didn't actually know that they were hard to get a look at, because when we were there, they were just out in the open constantly at the feeding station.
They can be. Sometimes they're like that, but other times.
Yeah, Lunatiscosa is a good place. If you just watch the feeding stations, they'll hang out on the edge.
Yeah, that's key, is go to feeding stations and just kind of wait there. Same thing with like white-tipped doves. That's another good one. They'll just kind of walk out. Those are big, chunky, like grapefruit-sized dove that just walks on the ground.
I feel like we clearly need a top 10 if there's this much debate about the top five.
Yeah, go to 10. Yeah. But Awnies are deserving. Awnies are definitely deserving of that fifth spot. They're such a cool, it's in the cuckoo family. They like hunt around in the grass and they'll pop up on a branch and be like, oh, cool, an Awny. And then you'll be like, choop, 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 choop. And there'll be like six of them that come out of nowhere from the grass right there. They've got these little like family groups. Awnies are really, really cool. They make a really interesting noise. That's just a really special bird, I think.
Yeah,
I feel like we could also go into the typical rarities that are down there too that you want to see. Also, absolutely. Like the rose of the Picard, like they usually get.
Perula.
Oh, I don't like talking about the tropical perula.
Yeah,
something interesting about Awnies is they've actually like been popping up in Louisiana pretty regularly too.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if that's where that's expanding a little
bit. It could be, yeah. But yeah, back to the rarities. So like rose-throated Picard, tropical perula.
Golden crown killer.
Is that just like a this year thing? Or is
No, we get one or two, at least recently, at least the last 5 or 6 years, we've had one or two almost every year, it seems like, every winter. Especially these small city parks like Frontera Audubon or the Valley Nature Center. We've had a few around for sure. Blue bunting is another one that's very common as far as rarities go. That's a really cool one.
Man, this makes me want to go back down to South Texas.
You gotta go.
I'm just thinking about how fun that last trip was. It was just such a special place.
The grosbeak, crimson-collared grosbeak, is another one. That's every winter or two, we'll get one or two of them. Yeah.
Man, why didn't we have that stuff last winter?
That wasn't even there at the festival. Like, one showed up like a week or two after. It kind of seems like it ebbs and flows. You know, something will get added, something will not be seen for a bit.
I think we'd be remiss if we did not talk about all of the random parrots that are down there.
Yes, yeah. And so that was another one I almost put on the list as well. You know, if we're putting a top 10, red-crowned parrots definitely getting in there. Our countable, as far as eBird or ABA standards go, birds are red-crowned parrot, which is a very endangered parrot, actually, in Mexico. There's only a couple thousand left in their native breeding range, which isn't that far away, south of the border. There's been a lot of speculation about the birds here being, you know, maybe a combination of some wild birds in addition to a lot of, you know, released birds that have just started breeding on their own. And it's subtropical here, so they can survive fine. There's a lot of planted fruit-bearing trees now. And so when they came up 30, 40, 50 years ago, whatever it was, when they started showing up here and being able to survive, that's probably had a big reason for it. One was all of the fruit and nut bearing trees that we have now that are exotic, or even things like oaks. You know, we brought in oaks down here, but also all of the cavities. So we brought all of these non-native palm trees, and woodpeckers go nuts on dying palms, and red crowns need cavities, and so they'll utilize those you know, all over the place. And so that combination of, you know, the subtropical environment and the food and the nesting space is just like, okay, great. So we actually have, you know, a similar number, if not more, red crowns here in the U.S. now than we do native in Mexico.
Not just the red crowns either. You guys have the lilac crowns, and is it yellow lotus as well?
Those aren't countable though, right? It's just red crown and then green, I believe, is countable.
Yeah, green parakeet is the other one. Yeah, that's naturalized. So those ones definitely are not native from what I understand. But yeah, then you have lilac crowned, red lord, and white fronted are all on eBird, at least. You'll see them as provisional, which means they are increasing, and they may become naturalized at one point soon. But right now we're still kind of watching the trends, but it does count on your eBird list technically right now. One other species we have is called yellow-headed, and that is still considered an escapee. Sure. So they're very low numbers, you know, like one in every parrot flock. So we have parrot flocks that go to roost together in the evenings. They'll spread out during the day and then they'll come together to roost. And there are big roosts in Brownsville, Harlingen, Weslaco, and McAllen. So these four big roosts, a couple hundred birds each. And we, you know, some of these other species mix in and even hybridize. Over in McAllen, there's a lot of lilac crowns that hybridize with the red crowns. So it's becoming a little bit of a messy situation over there. And they're very, very, very similar.
Dang hybrids, you know.
Well, it's wild to see those parrots coming to roost too, because we tried twice. And the first time they came when it was like dark.
Yeah.
You give me that look for.
I was just looking, corroborating your story.
It was like you were questioning me, and I was like, am I wrong about something? It was dark when they came, but you hear the noises and you're just like, yeah, I can tell there's tons of birds in that tree or something. And then the second time they all were eating fruit and on power lines before they went into the same tree to roost. But the noise is just crazy.
Yeah. And so the first time they didn't really roost where we were. And so it was just like, you heard all this noise from a tree. And then at one point it just all went silent. And if you didn't watch, you would have no idea there were tons of parrots in there. And then the second time, they were like right next to us. It's just like the cacophony is so loud. You're just like, I can't believe that, like, I'm in the middle of this, you know, these parrots feasting and just hanging out there. Yeah, it's definitely something you have to experience. And on the festival, we did the Parrotpalooza trips so that people could go with us to the different parrot spots and then get to see them as they kind of came in.
Do you now know which parrot spots are the best? Like, if we go down there again, are you like, I know the go-to parrot spot?
I know a place.
Oh, you know a place. I know a place. Okay.
Yeah.
He's got the ins now.
And
yeah, I imagine living at those houses where the parrots roost above.
Yeah. So I felt like in Los Angeles, when I saw the red-crowned parrots there, people were more like, comments were like, oh, we need to shoot these things. Like, they were very like negative. Like, I hate hearing these things. But I feel like in Texas, people were like, yeah, those are our parrots.
I think they like them.
I think they are proud of the parrots. Some guy was like, those used to be in my college all the time. Remember that?
Yeah.
It's funny.
One thing I did want to mention with the festival was Mary Gustafson's role in years past. I heard a little bit about Mary, but if you want to just talk a little bit about, her influence on the festival over the years.
Yeah, she's kind of been all over the, not even just Texas birding scene, but world birding scene, I guess. And she had traveled all over. But I know she was on, the Texas Rare Bird, Texas Bird Records Committee, validating or talking about birds to add to the state checklist. She was a massive eBird reviewer, spent a ton of volunteer time doing that. She was a private bird guide down here as well for a couple decades, and then of course was the did what I'm doing now, trip and guide coordinator for the festival. She had done it off and on for a long time. I actually don't know exactly when she started doing that, but she was kind of the like the festival mom, I guess, in a way. Everybody respected her. Not everybody loved her because she cracked the whip pretty hard, but everybody respected her. And so, she kind of really set the Rio Grande Valley Birding Festival, I feel like, to how it is now. As far as guides go, at least, and how trips are set up. And so, if you come on the festival in future years, a lot of the trips that, currently are running are ones that she initiated, or folks that some of the guides that are brought in now are people that she found at one point, and we keep bringing them back because they're great guides. But yeah, so she of course passed away shortly after the festival in 22. And a couple months later is when they had asked me to take over for a while at least. I did it last year, it went well. I'll at least do it one more year. We'll see how next year goes. It'll be good to get a lot of the kinks finally worked out now that I know how everything runs. And so I'm looking forward to it this year. But we'll see, how it goes, and see what else can maybe need improving for 24.
And then you eventually pass it on to Ryan Rodriguez.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the birding phenom of South Texas. Yeah,
Yeah, how old is Ryan?
he is 16 now.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, Ryan's a really phenomenal birder.
Not allowed to drink.
Homeschooled, super young. But if you run into him in the valley, he's definitely gonna give you some information about the stuff in the area, birds, butterflies, really,
He was a wild
anything.
card. He just like rolled in on his bike to Benson, and then he's just like, "Oh, there's the Rose Throated Bacard," and then
You
he,
gave him a Midwest
yeah,
oath. I don't know about
and that's how I picture him in my
that
head. He's gonna, yeah, and then he's like, "You guys want to see the kites? We can go find the kites."
Yeah, because like we met him for the first time there, and then we ended up just birding with him like the whole day.
Yeah,
But
he's fantastic.
those homeschool birders, man, they got way more time than the usual
There's one
person.
of them in every state like that. We have one too.
You would never guess that he's homeschooled. He's one of, if not the sharpest 16-year-old like I've ever met. I mean, there's
What
a
do
point
you
where
that's how you tell they're homeschooled.
what do you
Well,
try to
that's
say about
true.
homeschool
That's
people,
true.
Justin?
I was gonna say there's a stereotype for sure. At least when I grew up thinking, hearing about homeschool kids and, they just didn't get along at school or whatever. But like, that completely humbled me meeting Ryan and like learning that he's this homeschooled kid because he's exceptional. Like he's so professional and knowledgeable, and he studies a lot, which is how he learns this stuff, but he retains it. He's super sharp. Like literally you'll hear a sparrow flying overhead, you'll hear a tsk, that's all you hear, and it'd be like grasshopper sparrow. It's like, what, are you kidding? There's no way. But he knows it. Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. And he's also leading trips at the ranch as a 16-year-old.
Yeah,
I
that's pretty
mean, he
crazy.
also kind of guided us around to a degree down there just by happenstance, and then we would invite him to go do stuff. But he's, yeah, definitely very good too. He found us a tarantula, same situation. He heard it, right away, and then we pinpointed it. And yeah, so good to have you guys as guides down there. People that go with either of you are in great hands.
Yeah, appreciate that.
You also did a county big year this year, huh?
I did. Yeah. That
Breaking
was a
some
long
records from what I've heard.
Oh, no one birded in your county before?
time. Something like that. Yeah. No, it was
Ryan Rodriguez listening.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm curious to see if anybody will try to beat it here in future years, but this year it's just been like this fall and winter has just been wild. I started doing a big year just kind of like haphazardly, not trying to go too hard and just try to maybe break the record this year again. which was 329 for the county.
Which county?
Cameron County. This is the coastal southernmost tip of Texas, basically. So if you follow coast all the way down to where it hits Mexico, it encompasses Harlingen, Brownsville, and South Padre, basically, is the kind of little tri-city area. I had hit the record in 2019 at 326. Nobody had really done much of a big year at all, it seemed like, at that point. And even then, I didn't go too hard and missed a number of birds. Another guy down here, a buddy of mine named Javi Gonzalez, who, if you've gone to the Valley before, you may have met him. He works at the birding center on the island. Fantastic birder and guide as well, and naturalist. He broke it at 329, so he added a few that next year. That was COVID year. And of course, he's always on the island, so anything that pops up, you know, migratory wise, these rarities that only stay for a few hours, he usually gets those. And then this year I was like, I'll just go for it again. And wound up with 346. So I topped Hobbies by 17 birds.
Well, dang.
And that's literally the number like of birds that I've added to my all-time county list just since this fall. So like that's how many crazy birds have showed up just this fall and winter. Just so many, like I said, northern, western, and Mexican vagrants. Birds from every direction basically showing up here. It's been really, really exceptional.
What was the craziest county one you had this year?
I think the Bacard was theoretically the rarest, the gray-collared Bacard.
Oh, gotcha.
Being a ABA area third, US third. That was, I think, definitely the rarest. Roadside Hawk is very good. Golden Crown Warbler, fairly rare. Rose throated Bacard, fairly rare. There's only a couple records of another good one. We had a Lapland Longspur. One of the days I was at Resaca de la Palma, actually. Thank God I was standing next to Ryan. And we heard this like chattering call, this like rattle call fly over. And I was like, I know that call. And I didn't know what it was from. And Ryan went, he was literally talking on the phone 10 feet away. And he went, Lapland Longspur? That's how crazy he is. He's nuts. And I was like, that's why, because it sounds like a snow bunting, and I know snow bunting super well from Vermont. It's this like, you know, rattle call. Thank God it also, the bird kind of, I don't know if it's the same bird or a different one, but it flew back around maybe 5-10 minutes later, did another pass. There's some fields just out front of Resaca, and so I don't know if they were out there and hanging out or what, but that was a really good bird for Cameron County as well. We just don't get those birds down here, at least, you know, that people can find. Maybe they're in the fields, but we have a lot of vast ag fields. So those are a couple of really good birds for this year.
Ryan was actually telling us that a lot of people miss the flyover stuff like that. And I forget what bird he was saying specifically. I thought it was like horned lark or Lapland Longspur, actually. He's like, actually, a lot more of them are around than you would think.
I bet it was Ben Sprague.
It could have been.
Yeah. I bet that I would put a lot of money that it's a Sprague's Pipit. Yeah. Cause they're,
yeah. That's one when like we're birding together, you're always like Sprague's Pipit.
Yeah. Well, we're American but yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Both. Yeah. Sprague's is just a little bit squishier sounding, but
yeah, I remember you mentioning that.
If you're not listening for it or you just don't hear well, you'll miss them.
Brutal out there.
Yeah. So do you currently have a nemesis bird?
Or just a nemesis?
I do from Vermont. I feel like I haven't made trips up to see them lately, but there's a species called spruce grouse up there, which do you guys get those in Wisconsin?
Yeah,
we actually have a state record spruce grouse that we saw.
Ah, okay. Okay, nice.
State record just as we saw. Us, yeah, I was like, is there something special about it? I don't know.
People don't see them as much anymore, I don't think. Boreal species, like there used to be blackback woodpecker in the northern part of the state, boreal chickadee, Canada jay, spruce grouse all used to be way more common, and now they're just not so much anymore. So
okay. Yeah, that's how it is in kind of Vermont. I think it's becoming restricted a little bit, but it's really just like there's a pocket in the what we call the Northeast Kingdom, Northeast corner of Vermont, where you can get those four species. And I never got a spruce grouse up there. And so I now live here, so makes it a little tougher to chase. But no, not for Texas. I mean, I've seen, not for South Texas at least. I'm not a super long distance chaser anymore. I used to be back in my early birding days, but now I really enjoy the local, like, county stuff, or maybe, you know, valley specific stuff. I find it a lot of fun.
I gotta ask, did you ever see the cattle tyrant?
So my organization's offices are based up there, and so I make regular trips up there, and I've been there twice since the bird was there. Swung by one time, I was there for a good hour or two twice that day, and it was one of the finickier days that the bird had. Didn't get it. I knew it was roosting on a roof, like, literally, like, I could see the roof. I'm like, people said it went right there, but you just can't see it. I even went up onto a parking garage and trying to, like, look down in. You can't see behind some walls. And then the second time I went up and swung through the intersection, didn't have much time, but didn't see it. So I'll be back up there next week for first aid training. So try number three. We'll see. But
I think you'll get it done.
Hopefully, we'll see. But really? Even that's one that's rare.
People unfamiliar, it's a really rare South American species that people presume probably hopped on a boat, hopped off, and now it's in Texas.
Yeah, Corpus Christi. Yep, and it's been there since the birding festival. I think the last day of the birding festival, maybe, or the second to last day.
Yeah, because I remember we were coming back from Santa Margarita, and we were like, oh man, that's like. That's cool. That's so different. Yeah, it's crazy that thing is still hanging around and hanging out in the dumpsters.
Eating flies.
What a life. Well, cool. One last thing. You know, we have a lot of people from different levels that check out the show and the podcast. Do you have any advice for young birders? And, you know, I guess just people kind of more seasoned, so young birders, and then, like, you know, people that might need a new goal, new way to keep things interesting.
Sure. I would say really try to learn your calls, I guess, as a newer birder. Learn, you know, get out there with people who know what they're doing. Like, join any bird walks you can, just because having somebody there that knows the sounds especially, but also the sights. You know, when you're out on a bird walk, probably 60 or 70% of my birding now is by ear only. So, you know, I say, oh, there's an olive sparrow, there's an orange crown warbler, there's a white tip dove. Oh, there is a Kiskadee. Like, I see it, you know. So for every one bird I see, I hear three or four more. And it's very common. And if you don't know what all these things are by ear, you might spend time chasing an olive sparrow for so long, and then you finally see it and you're like, oh man, it's just an olive sparrow this whole time. So once you start to get those little calls down, you can really focus your time birding and, you know, really utilize it, you know, trying to find whatever you want to find. I mean, maybe you do just want to go look at every olive sparrow, but so for newer birders, I would say that, you know, join some walks and try to learn from some more experienced people in the field, and then, you know, practice at home and stuff too. Listen to some calls.
I like the budgies started going off.
What's that? Yeah. Oh yeah.
You're like, got to listen for the calls. All of a sudden they start making their noises.
Yeah. And for more experienced people, I would say, I think, you know, what I just did with that county year, you learn a lot about birds having to go to the one little, like, grassland, or the one, you know, these certain types of ponds in your county, to find these certain birds, or like Paraluxia is one that's all over down here. The cousin of the cardinal, really, I love it. I think it's the more elegant version. But they need, like, this kind of desert scrub, and you just don't have a ton of that in this county. You go over to Hidalgo County, you can get tons of it. They're all over. And so it just kind of forces you to go to different places you might not have, or to learn more about, you know, these species, and figure out where you might find them in your county in, you know, maybe just slightly suitable habitat. But I learned a lot these couple years that I've done that, and it's really a lot of fun. So I would recommend that.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us. If people want to do tours with you, can they reach out to you if they're going to be in the valley?
Yeah. This year, it's been a lot of my time going to Santa Margarita for sure. But if folks, you know, if anybody has questions, I'm always happy to answer those. I also do some eBird reviewing down here. So yeah, if people want to email me, that would be fine. It's justin.leclaire, LECLAIRE 87 at gmail.com. Happy to field any questions, or yeah, if you need a, you know, directions pointed for tour guides or for Santa Margarita Ranch, or, you know, whatever, really, I'm happy to answer questions.
Cool. What's the 87 for?
It's just a random lucky number. I was born in 90. but, you know, back in the day, growing up, like, I think one of my favorite hockey players had 87, and I just kept seeing it randomly, and I'm like, man, that's my lucky number. It's stuck.
Fair enough.
I should just lie and say that's my age because it's so close. They're not my age, but my birth year.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for joining us, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for watching this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.